Our last speaker is Matthew Morris from Ambrose University in Calgary, Alberta. Matthew, welcome here. Please go right ahead.
Hey, thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. My name is Matthew Morris, associate professor of biology at Ambrose University. And I'm presenting today some work I've done in collaboration with Dr. Beth Stavell, who's professor of Old Testament at Ambrose as well. She's handling the theological side of things because the more I talk to her, the more I understand how little I understand about theology, and I desperately need a theologian to help inform our conversations. This work is coming out of Science for Seminaries opportunity that Beth and I got to engage in as we started to think about how biology and the Pentateuch relate. We hit on Adam's naming of the animals and generated this really fruitful dialogue on taxonomy, the biology of naming, and a biblical theology of naming. So we wrote a paper on that, and after we published the paper, this whole sort of boring world of taxonomy that like nobody cares about and you're forced to learn in high school suddenly exploded in the pages of Nature and in popular blogs all around the issue of naming. So what I want to talk about today is an extension of the work that we've been doing on the promises and pitfalls of renaming species. Now, the controversy exploded in 2019 first. There was some sort of stuff before that, but it really centered on this bird, this little inconspicuous, what ornithologists call an LBB, a little brown bird, one of those creatures that are hard to identify. It doesn't look like a creature of controversy, but the controversy centered not around the bird itself, but around its name. Now, many living things, not all, but many living things have two different types of names, and these different names have different sorts of properties. So we have McCown's longspur is the common name for this creature in English. Rincophanes McCownii is the scientific name for this creature, which is actually updated. The abstract has an older name. It was just recently changed to Rincophanes. Now, these two types of names have different connotations. Common names are in the philosophy of naming what we call an appellative. What this means is that when we hear the name McCown's longspur, or maybe a crow or something like this that you actually have seen before, that name has a series of semantic linkages, a series of attributes that connect that name to a community of organisms. So there's semantic content to these common names. Common names are not hypotheses, they're not scientific hypotheses. So a common name doesn't tell us anything about evolutionary relationships. And common names typically lack legislative power. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. Scientific names, on the other hand, are philosophically seen by taxonomists as being what we refer to as direct references. What this means is that there's no semantic linkage between the name and the creature being named. So think of it almost as like a QR code. There's no content in that QR code. It just takes us from a series of letters to a type specimen in a museum. However, these names are scientific hypotheses. Whatever that assemblage of letters is, it does connect to a genus, to a family, to an order. And so we can update, we have to test these names and update them in light of changing evolutionary knowledge. And these scientific names do have legislative power. It is the scientific name, not the species itself, that is protected in American and Canadian law. So if we change a scientific name, it has the capability of removing protections from that creature until legislation is able to catch up. So taxonomists have some rare cases where they actually don't update a scientific name if it's going to jeopardize the sustainability of that species. Now, it wasn't the scientific name that was the source of controversy for this creature, at least not initially. It was the common name, McCown's longspur. This name, McCown longspur, comes from John McCown from the 1800s. Now, this is not a man we know a lot about. He fought in the U.S. Army. He was stationed down in Mexico for a time and fought down there. Then he was stationed in Texas. In Texas, he shot a little brown bird, kind of dabbled in ornithology. He shot this little brown bird, shipped it to his friend George Lawrence, who was an ornithologist. George recognized it as a species new to science and then named it in the scientific name. He named it after his friend John McCown. Later, that name got established. McCown was established in the common name. Now, in 2019, Bird Names for Birds, this little social group, that believes birds shouldn't have human names in them, petitioned the American Ornithological Society to rename McCown's longspur. And the reason they cited is that McCown, after killing this bird, he defected from the U.S. Army and he fought for the South in the Civil War. So they viewed his actions as being sort of pro-slavery, and that this is not someone that we want to honor and commemorate for future generations in the name of a bird. The American Ornithological Society said, no, we're going to keep this as McCown's longspur. And then in 2020, on the same day, two tragedies struck. George Floyd was horrifically murdered by a police officer. And on the same day in Central Park in New York City, Christian Cooper and a black man was out bird watching and was accosted by a white woman who was walking her dog, and it was recorded and it went viral. So in response to that, birding organizations thought, how can we make birding safe for people of color? And so they instituted Black Birders Week. This gained a lot of traction. And so Bird Name for Birds reappealed to the American Ornithological Society. And whereas before it was 100% against renaming, now it was two abstentions and the rest in favor of renaming. And so the bird was renamed the thick-billed longspur, which is simply a translation of rhynchophides. So that was in 2020. But you'll notice McCownii is still there in the scientific name. And so the debate didn't end there. It's just really started. Should we be removing all eponyms from scientific and common names of living things? And just to point out, this is not a small thing. This wouldn't be an easy change, right? In the animal world, we're dealing with 20% of all named animals bear eponyms. That's over 300,000 species that bear human names. And this can run a sort of a moral spectrum, if you will. Coregonus artidae is named for Peter Artidae, a famous ichthyologist, friend of Linnaeus, helped like get Linnaeus going, who died at a tragically young age. He drowned in Amsterdam. We don't have any really like horrific deeds that he committed against anyone apart from imbibing the sort of cultural values of his age. Whereas, you're not reading this wrong, this Slovenian blind cave beetle was and bears the name of Hitler. It was named for the, at the time, Führer of Germany, and it still bears his name today. Now, scientists, taxonomists, they use eponyms for a variety of reasons, most often to honor somebody. They want to honor friends or family or loved ones. Sometimes they want to honor their pets. More often, they honor collaborators or people who have done lots of work. So if you've worked for decades on some group of wasps, you'll likely have a wasp named after you at some point, right? Sometimes it's to honor celebrities, pop culture icons, politicians, people that they enjoy. Rarely you get things named out of spite. So Linnaeus famously named a weed after a scientific rival. You get particularly ugly or parasitic organisms sometimes named after ex-lovers, and then they're there ingrained in those scientific names for all time. More commonly, the taxonomist will choose a person that they want to get something out of, right? So you'll see here, these are for African vertebrates, but except for fish. These are mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles. You'll see there's quite a few that are named after nobility. There's quite a few named after bankers, quite a few named after colonial administrators. That's because the taxonomists of that time wanted to get something out of those people. They wanted funding, right? Or they wanted to be in good relationship with those members of the nobility. Also point out, you can see the countries that these people are, the people whose names these species bear, where those people come from. So these are African vertebrates, but Africa doesn't show up on here, right? Sometimes it's a little more complicated. This creature was named recently after Donald Trump. This is a legless Sicilian. It's an amphibian. The naming rights were auctioned out. The people who bought the naming rights, it was an environmental group. This creature burrows itself in the dirt. They saw this as akin to Trump's climate change policy, sticking his head in the sand. So they named it as a political statement. But 100 years from now, nobody's going to know that. They're just going to know that this creature bears the name of Donald Trump, right? And there may be issues that they take with that. So there's been this now in 2023, this explosion of opinion pieces in the pages of Nature with people for and against removing eponyms. And I should point out that people for and against are across the entire cultural spectrum in the global north and the global south. So it's not like it's the northerns against the southerns or anything like this. It's truly a diverse conversation. But the reasons that are cited for removing eponyms are, there's four major reasons. Social equity. Species that have eponyms are largely named after white European men. even if those white European men don't live around those creatures or aren't in relationship with those creatures. Women, indigenous leaders are typically excluded. They talk about protection. Imagine you are a marginalized people group living in relationship with a creature, and that creature bears the name of people who did violence against you or your ancestors, right? So the idea here is that there might be a lack of incentives for conserving creatures that bear those names by the people who live in community with those creatures. There's the nature of names. Bird Names for Birds argues that eponyms are quote-unquote verbal statues. Just like we have historical statues of historical figures that have been taken down in certain cities across North America, these names, here they're talking about common names, but the arguments could be applied to scientific names as well. They're verbal statues that commemorate the values of the person so named. So if taxonomists are using these names, they are upholding the values of those people. And there are ethical arguments, this idea that values have progressed and changed. Stodgy taxonomists shouldn't be relying on rules that they established 100 years ago. Values have progressed, and so the rules for naming need to be updated. Opponents of renaming cite the same four categories, but for different reasons. So social equity. Marginalized taxonomists in the global south finally have a voice, and they're crying foul. They're saying, you people have been naming creatures for generations. After your heroes, now it's our turn. We can now name these species after our heroes, after our mentors. And now you're telling us that we can't do this. For protection of species, people in the global south, taxonomists in the global south typically are underfunded. They have a ton of species that still need naming in order to protect them. And so to get money, they auction off naming rights. And the people who buy those naming rights typically do so to name the creature after someone they love. And then that money has, like, this isn't just a hypothetical, the money does get used to conserve land and foster further taxonomic work. They also cite the taxonomic impediment. There are more species to be named than taxonomists to possibly do it in anyone's lifetime. So if we have to rename 300,000 species, that takes away from naming a whole suite of creatures that have yet to have names. There's the nature of scientific names. Scientific names are intended to be stable, but you want us to change these names. Synonymy is often cited. So what this means is that if a scientific name is changed, that name doesn't go away. It's now synonymous. It is a valid scientific name that is still used in all the publications as a list of synonyms. So it's not like you've taken down the verbal statue. You've just sort of moved it off to the side, but it will always be there. And they say, it lacks semantic content, so you shouldn't be offended by the scientific name because it doesn't actually mean anything. It just refers to a type specimen. And then they cite ethics as a concern, that the moral landscape, if it's constantly shifting, we can't be updating species names as culture changes over time, right? So in 100 years, perhaps we'll have a different relationship with problematic historic figures, or we may have a different way of dealing with them than toppling statues or what have you. So, the official position, the International Commission on Zoological Nomenclature, these are like the people who govern the rules for naming animals. Their official position is that it's outside the scope of the commission to assess the morality of persons honored in eponyms. And they go on to essentially say, we're taxonomists, not ethicists. We're not equipped to do this, right? So this is where, and very briefly, Beth and I have been thinking about whether there are biblical principles that we could take from a biblical theology of naming to apply to this conversation, not to come up with like be all and end all solutions, but just what theologically, what can we contribute to this conversation? Only looking at a theology of naming. So it's sort of narrow parameters. And if she were here, she would do a much better job than I am, but I will do my best to communicate these principles to you. But they're rooted ultimately in the love of God and the love of neighbor. So first, looking across the Old Testament, but particularly in the Pentateuch, we see that naming is relational and value-laden, right? Naming often emerges out of a relationship between God and his people, between people and the creatures that live around them, or people in the geographic spaces that they inhabit. Names aren't just sort of chosen at random. They emerge organically out of relationship and often have real semantic content. Right? They establish functional roles, or they say something about one's relationship with God. So Adam from the ground, like that mean something. Eve, mother of the living, means something. Abel, which means breath or vapor, points to his short life, right? And we could go on and on and on and on with all sorts of names that have real semantic content. So naming biblically is more akin to common naming practices than to scientific naming practices. And we can see what happens when we misname, right? When we apply incorrect names and how that affects our ability to live and be in the world. So David, when he goes out to fight the Philistines, your English translations will say, they'll call them the uncircumcised, but a more literal direct translation is that he's just calling them foreskins. The Philistines are foreskins. That is what he is naming them, this piece of skin that gets cut off by Israelite men. So he can dehumanize them and it makes it easier to go out and kill them, right? What we name has real consequences in how we live and be in this world. So Claude Stewart, in Redoing the First Work of Adam, argues that our patterns of naming reflect and condition our patterns of relating. Misnaming reflects a distorted way of looking at things and feeling about things. Worse, misnaming misleads action. Misnaming perpetuates misunderstanding, promotes mistreatment, and has consequences. Secondly, naming is a God-given affinity given to all. We see in Genesis 2, Adam is commanded to name the animals. And as we learned this morning, that just means Adam is earthling. It is both an individual person, but it is also all of humanity that is called to participate in this action of naming. And we bring this out a lot more in our 2021 article. But the idea here is that naming is not the responsibility for the elites or the powerful. It's the responsibility for everybody. And we see this extending in all sorts of applications. But for instance, Genesis 16:14, the first person in the Old Testament to give God a name is not Abraham. It's not the elites. It's not he'd expect. It's Hagar, right? Mistreated, outcast, vulnerable Hagar, who is the one with this honor of naming God first. Third, naming is for God's glory, not our own. Throughout Genesis 2 to 13, there's this common phrase to call upon the name of the Lord. This phrase is subverted in the Tower of Babel story, where instead of calling upon the name of the Lord, they are making a name for themselves. And the wordplay there suggests that naming is not, that's a bad thing, right? That making a name for ourselves is not the point of the narrative. We are to always be calling upon the name of the Lord. So naming should be for God's glory, not for our own glory. And finally, naming is protective. Now here we could get into all sorts of things, but I'll just point out Mu and Mu in creation care, who are appealing to Genesis 2, and they link Adam's naming of the animals to Adam's call to serve and protect the earth. And what they say is that the call to name, Adam's vocation to name, is not primarily about authority and domination, but instead a sign of knowing for the purpose of caring and protecting the created world. In other words, we first have to be in a relationship to provide names. Names flow out of this relationship that help us know the creature and be with the creature, and then we can better serve and protect the creature. But it starts with naming. So how do these principles apply to this debate around common names? Well, I just want you to reflect for a moment. How absurd is it that bird names for birds felt that they had to appeal to scientists about what they could call a creature, right? What are the scientists doing determining the common names for things? And I could go on for a while about this historical trajectory, but in the past, there were a multitude of common names for a single creature that emerged organically out of relationship with these things. I really like this example. This is from the UK, this little woodlouse. Look at all these fun, crunchy bat. I love that one, right? Isn't that a great name for a woodlouse? Growing up, we called them roly-polies. I've heard people call them pill bugs, potato bugs. There's all sorts of names for these fun little creatures, right? Because when you're a kid, you engage with them, you're in relationship with them, and names emerge. But what we've seen over the last 150 years or so is the increasing professionalization of biology. With that are standardized checklists that have the scientific names for creatures, but scientists quickly realized the public doesn't understand that. They don't understand scientific names. So to engage in communication, they needed also common names for creatures, which is totally ironic because the whole point of the scientific naming enterprise was to stabilize names. But then they went and they standardized common names as well. So you get the American Ornithological Society with their checklist of common names, the American Fisheries Society with their standardized common names. to the point that, I don't know if you ever heard like a scientist tell you, it's not a starfish, it's a sea star. No, let me have my starfish. That is not your concern. Common names are not scientific hypotheses. They have nothing to do with science. But we've handed our authority to name over to the scientists, and it disconnects us from nature. And secondly, we've seen global international apps that have, they don't have the wiggle room to have multiple common names for things, right? So they have the scientific name, and then they have one and only one common name. Whereas in the past, the Australian birders would have one standardized name for birds, and the Americans would have a different standardized name for the same bird. We're now seeing loss of even that diversity across the world with these international apps. So it's no longer a crunchy bat, it's now a common shiny woodlouse, which is just not as fun. So I think all the principles could relate to common naming, but I think the emphasis is on how naming is relational and naming is given to all. Common names are and should be an outpouring of relationship, not standardized or named by committee. Now, I'm not going to say that scientists can't do common names. They can. Absolutely, it is okay within the confines of a scientific organization to say, this is what we would prefer you to call these creatures in our journals. But to then tell the public what they can and cannot call these creatures, to my mind, is just beyond ridiculous. So the public needs to reclaim their call to name. Naming is the responsibility of all of us, not simply of the experts. Then about scientific names, what are we to do with eponyms in these scientific names? And here, I think the first and fourth principles are particularly useful. First, we need to recognize that naming is value-laden. It doesn't matter what the taxonomist thinks, that these are just a series of letters. Taxonomists lived in their own cultures with their own values, and they named species for a reason. Sometimes they gave ridiculous, like, ahaha is the name of a wasp. There's no real meaning there, other than it's fun. But often the names reflected their own cultural values. You can't do that and then say they don't have semantic content. But we're not computers, right? If there was no semantic, we would just do what they're doing on the Barcode of Life in just a series of random letters and numbers. But that's not what we've done because we're not robots. There is always semantic content to these names, or often semantic content to these names, whether we like it or not. We just have to recognize that's the reality. On the other hand, though, we have to recognize that naming is designed to be protective of the species. So we have to weigh these different ethical situations here. We have marginalized people groups who could have harm because there is semantic content to these scientific names. But on the other hand, changing the name could cause harm to the creature if legislation is slow to catch up, and it could cause harm to the creatures who don't yet have names. So we have to balance these two things and have a robust conversation about them. And that's where I'm not going to give final solutions. That's just where we're at. I would say, too, that there are some principles here for the church and for Christians who practice taxonomy. The first principle here is that naming is given to all of you, to all of us. What this means to me, anyways, is that Christians need to be letting youth know that taxonomy is not only a valid scientific enterprise, but it's a call for the Christian. It is a call for everyone. It is one of the first vocations given to humans, is to name and categorize the living world. And if we viewed naming in that lens, we could inspire more Christians to enter the world of taxonomy. The more people there are to name the creatures that don't yet have names, the less there is a taxonomic impediment that is preventing us from having these ethical conversations, right? Similarly, financial constraints. If we could inspire churches to give to scientists in the global south who are naming creatures, that can remove some of those financial constraints and permit them to have these ethical conversations. Secondly, the Christian taxonomist needs to recognize that naming is for God's glory. This is not going to fly with taxonomists in general, but the taxonomist who's naming species in the future needs to think carefully about the semantic content of the name they're giving that creature. To recognize that naming is not for self-aggrandizement or celebrity worship, but it's for the glory of God. Now, this doesn't mean name it like God's glorious monkey or something. But like, just think carefully about the meaning of the name and how that name could be read by others. I'll close with this, that this conversation is not going away. If you don't like this conversation, I understand it can be exhausting sometimes having naming conversations come up over and over and over again in all sorts of different contexts. But Eponyms are not just used in species names, they're used in geography, right? There are places that bear these names. Rhodesia, for instance, named after Rhodes. There's been a whole movement to eliminate Rhodes from scientific names. Just here's the weird thing. Species named after Rhodesia are not eponyms, they're toponyms. So if you got rid of all eponyms, you'd still have things bearing Rhodes' name because they're named after Rhodesia, the geographic place. So anyways, there's stuff to consider there. And in medicine as well, eponyms are in medical disorders. So this conversation is going to be all over the place. But also species have other potentially problematic names. And just how far do we go on this? So we have recently the gypsy moth was rebranded by the American Entomological Association because of the racial connotations there, right? There are species in the scientific name that have Hottentot in that name. So there's all sorts of problematic racial terms, right? There are geographic terms. COVID, we had all these strains named after geographic locations that were then renamed because of how problematic that was. And then we have things that, like, names that didn't intend to have or do harm. Black-eyed meant beautiful in an old poem, but for a battered woman who sees a black-eyed Susan in a garden, that could have significant connotations, right? So this conversation's not going anywhere. That's all I'm saying. It's not going anywhere. It's here to stay. So you can read, thank you to AAAS and Science for Seminaries Dozer. This is the original paper that got this conversation kickstarted. And here's a bunch of the current reading. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. So in the Bible, we see that God also renamed people. Abraham, so Paul, Simon Peter. So I guess that's kind of like some sort of theology of renaming. Is it part of the theology of naming that you're looking into?
Yeah, so... that's great. Beth and I are in initial stages on thinking about this, but yeah, renaming. So this is becoming a chapter for a book proposal we're putting together. Renaming, we fit into the relational side of things, right? That you can misname and name well, and as relationships change or as functions change, names change in the Old Testament. So all that fits into one's relationship. Common names change over time. Even McCown's longspur has gone through, I think, four different common names since it was discovered in the early or mid-1800s. But these common names typically flow out of one's relationship with the creatures. Yeah.
So first, I just have to trumpet the importance of getting people excited about taxonomy.
Right.
I love taxonomy. I'm a paleontologist and zoologist. I'm a birder. But I also have spent over a decade teaching anatomy now to medical, pre-medical students, nursing students, and things like that.
So for the record here, we have someone who loves taxonomy and thinks everyone should love taxonomy.
Yeah, that's absolutely. Put me on record. And even in the 10 years I've been teaching anatomy, textbooks have changed, right? So eponyms are being used for all kinds of structures in the body. And now those are being taken out with more descriptive names. So it's not fallopian tubes. Mm-hmm. It's uterine tubes. Uh-huh. It's not the circle of Willis at the base of the brain. It's the cerebral arterial circle now. Uh-huh. And for me, I see so much more utility in using a descriptive term rather than an eponym in describing parts of the body.
Yeah.
So just wondering if any of the sort of guidelines that you guys have been thinking about with taxonomy might function in a different way if we're thinking about anatomical terminology. So
those anatomical terms are typically more precise and have very particular scientific meanings, whereas scientific names have never really functioned in that same sort of way. In the animal world, we have a fathead minnow, and I wonder if that's going to come up eventually. There's all sorts of descriptive terms that can be problematic because we're not dealing with very precise scientific language in either the common or scientific names of creatures. That's quite different from what you have in the world of anatomy. I don't know if that answered your question, though.
Just thinking about some of the guidelines you give might be applied differently. Mm-hmm. Or we might think about naming in a different way when it's not just the name of the species versus...
You think, for instance, of disorders that are named after not the discoverer of the disorder, but the first person to have that disorder, and their name is immortalized, and you get pictures of them in like the height of their suffering. And there's all sorts of problematic stuff there, isn't there? With one of the things with scientific names that is maybe different from anatomy, though, and we didn't touch on this at all, but taxonomists, in a sense, are creative artists. And so how much do we honor the creative contribution of the taxonomist when the name that they've given is carving out something that nobody saw before, right? So I think it's almost akin to like an artist with a problematic life who did this painting, and how do we sort of relate to that painting or that movie now, which is maybe a little bit different from what you get in anatomy.
Concerning the standardization of common names, with the rise of the importance of citizen science, which in field ornithology is very important, it could be argued, I would argue, that we need the scientific names do not communicate very well with the typical expert bird, and that the standardization of common names definitely helps towards the conservation of the species.
Yeah, so the point here is that as citizen science has become increasingly important, scientific names don't have the same sort of significance for the public as common names do. And so standardization, so that ornithologists can talk to one another, sort of lay ornithologists can talk to one another, standardization is important. And I'd agree with you in the context of that particular community, right? But to say that others outside of that community can't have other common names for these birds, and to say that we scientists are going to dictate for all time, so that there's actually a board with a series of rules very similar to scientific naming rules. There's a series of rules, and you have to go through this whole like voting procedure. All that stuff just seems ridiculous to me. I'm sorry. I do get the role that standardization plays, but to say that there's the scientific authority behind those common names, that's where I start to have problems.
Well, I hope that our speakers this afternoon, this morning, might linger a little bit here for those of you who may have some more questions.
I'd like to invite you all to join me in thanking our speakers one more time for excellent presentations.